So welcome to Voices of Women. I'm Chris Stainis, and I am your host, and I'm also the founder of Woman of Wisdom Foundation and 30 years of putting on the Woman of Wisdom Conference here in Seattle, Washington. So glad that you are joining us. My guest today is Lisa Marshall. She is a fierce elder and grandmother who aspires to be a good ancestor. She lives on the yin side of the first mountain in the ancient mountains that run along the eastern side of the U.S. She has a long, rewarding career as an executive coach, straddling the corporate world and spiritual life, working to help clients to find their voices and their paths, and in doing so, become their most powerful and realized selves. She understands the power of story and that stories live in our bodies. And she is deeply committed to the idea that our purpose in life is always, whatever path we take, to grow up, to mature, to become an elder. Lisa writes books and poetry and is fascinated by the idea of learning to listen to the natural world as well as she listens to her clients. She finds most voices especially compelling. Lisa is the author of her book, Yin, Completing the Leadership Journey, and that's what we're going to talk about today. So welcome, Lisa.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yes. Well, what inspired you to write this book, Yin?
What inspired me was the events of 2019 and 2020, in the context of having been told by one of my teachers that I needed to write a book about leadership for women several years earlier, and feeling very stuck about that for a long time. I'd written another book on leadership, and I thought I put everything in there I knew. So what else am I supposed to say? But watching Black Lives Matter, watching the Me Too movement, watching how we reacted to the pandemic, and having knee surgery, all in the same fairly condensed period of time, made me realize what had been missing. I had used the model of the hero's journey as the structure for my book on leadership. And a number of women had said to me over the years, isn't that really a story for men? Does that fit us? And my response had always been, well, if you're not the hero in your own story, who is? And I still stand by that. But what I came to understand was that there was a different path. And I found myself very drawn to using the language of yin and yang rather than male and female or masculine and feminine, because that language has gotten so politicized and so touchy these days. And what I'm talking about is really qualities of energies. It's not biologically specific. It evolved biologically, but that's not the same thing. So when I began to see that there was a journey to find one's voice that is very different than the yang journey to make a mark in the world, to bring back the golden fleece, to do all the yanging around that our traditional heroes have done, you know, slaying dragons, whatever, you know, that there was a different, equally important, equally intense and difficult journey to go inside ourselves and find our own voices and speak for ourselves. I was watching these people do it, and it was gorgeous to watch, and nobody'd ever said anything about that I could find. During 2020, while I was recovering from the knee surgery, I started writing. It was completely different than anything I'd ever written before, which, you know, I had an outline and you follow the outline and you fill in the blanks and et cetera, et cetera. This was peeling an onion. I think the first thing I wrote turned out to be about 13 pages long. And I read it and I sat with it for a while. And then I added to it. And then I read that and sat with it for a while and added to it. And after a while, I had, it's not a big book, but I reached a point of knowing I mostly said what I wanted to say. And one of my colleagues read it and said, but there's no stories in here, Lisa. You talk about story, but you don't tell stories, and people want stories in order to see how it could work. And I had a really visceral reaction to that, because if the point of this book was that we need to find our own stories, then I needed the readers to be working on their stories, not reading about how other people did things. So it turned into kind of a little workbook. I did a spiral binding on it so you could lay it flat. There's questions, there's space to write. And the format is a short chapter, and then think about this, you know. And the goal is for people to evolve an understanding of what their story has been and what they want their story to be. And I don't put many examples or other people's stories in it, because I really want them focusing on, you know, their own interior process. So it took about a year, peeling a layer of the onion, or adding a layer of the onion. I'm not quite sure what that, which way to run that metaphor, but at some point I knew I was done. And I published it at the end of 2020, and was really pleased to be able to tell my teacher, it took me 7 years, but I did it. I wasn't sure I would be, but I'm still quite pleased with what this is. It's just a different conversation than I think anybody else is having.
Yes, no, it's great. And I like it. I work in circle leadership. It's very similar, but to use the word yin, and in the book, you describe yin leadership. So maybe we could go into that a little bit. And I love the fact that your stories, people, you write your own story. You're allowed space for people to claim their own story. And that's what's important. Stories became an aspect of woman wisdom from the very first year. People being workshops is a place that women could share their stories. And it's very healing, very powerful. So the fact that you recognize the importance of, we listen to other people's stories all the time, but how about, you know, claiming our own, writing our own, and then sharing it out there in the world, I think it's very important. And so, you know, the next step is to share your story. So let's start with, describing a yin leadership style. What does
a yin leadership style has four key attributes. The first one is caring and concern as central. It's the central organizing principle of decision making when you have yin leadership in an organization. It's, you know, what does this mean for the people? How does it impact people, et cetera, et cetera? So that's primary. You know, in North American indigenous cultures, the rule was framed this way: no law can hurt the children. I think that's a beautiful way to put it. You know, if it hurts the children, it cannot become law. A second element of yin leadership is collaboration. This is where your circles become so, so important. Collaborative leadership is critical for good decision making. It's also a little slower. And in our young world, that often doesn't play well. And I've worked with executives and basically had to show them, look, that decision that you made so quickly and railroaded through, it got sabotaged at 14 different levels. This other one where you moved a little more slowly and got some buy-in, that one stuck. But all your speedy decision-making, it buckles under pressure or it gets sabotaged. There's a wonderful phrase, malicious compliance, where people do exactly what you said, which is not what you really meant and you were hoping they understood. And they're pissed and they just do what you told them to do. And you have a catastrophe as a result. Autocracy is highly prized in certain settings, and certainly in the C-suite. The problem is it doesn't build maturity. You know, slow, thoughtful decision-making helps build maturity in your whole organization. The third attribute is what I call grounded truthfulness, being willing to look straight on at reality, not pretend, not wish, not live in denial. This is where good data gathering matters. This is where reality matters. And this is a key attribute for making decisions and getting an organization moving in ways that will stay consistent over time. The last one I would say is what I call generativity, being imaginative enough to create an alternative future that's appealing to people and invites them to it. Robert Diltz's definition of a leader as someone who creates worlds other people want to belong to remains one of my favorite definitions after 30 some years. So I named the title of my first book on leadership was Speak the Truth and Point to Hope, The Leader's Journey to Maturity. And I think that that is still critical to effective yin leadership. But, you know, they have to see the truth, speak the truth, and then see a way forward and offer that to people. So those are the sort of key attributes, I think, for yin leadership. Probably very similar to what you teach with your circles, because it's the old knowledge, you know. Indigenous people know this everywhere. The people who are still in touch with the earth know it everywhere. It's just the Western economic machinery that has lost track of these basic things.
Yes, and all those characteristics they're very important. And they're important in that it's the process. You get involved in the process. Jean Houston says, you know, the female way of leadership or working is the process. And that isn't also the feminine characteristic. So it's not a gender thing also, but it's the process versus the product. And we live in a world that is so product oriented in the final results and going, like you say, you know, going something. Yeah, we go too fast. We're in this society that just moves. We expect things to just go, go, go.
Right, right. And then it eats us up.
Yeah. So in the other aspect of your book, you talk about the difference of yin and yang. And also what I love is you have a chapter on the healthy yang. And that's what's needed also. Besides the yin leadership, we need a healthy yang.
Yes. And a healthy yang is basically designed to be in service. The one sort of format that I've seen in corporate training that speaks to this is the notion of servant leadership, you know, which is originally the work of John Greenleaf, who was a Quaker who inverted the pyramid and put the people on the top and the CEO at the bottom and said the CEO's whole job is to take care of the people. And if he or she is not doing that, they're not doing their job. That notion of being in service to the organization, to the not the product, but to the impact that the organization wants to have on the world is so counter to our culture of egomaniacal CEOs. And yet people do know who in their organization takes care of their people, and they gravitate to those places, and they are, you know, afraid of the places where the CEO has, as they said in Good to Great, the CEO looks in the mirror when there's credit to be given and out the window when there's blame, whereas the great CEOs look in the mirror when there's blame. They take responsibility for that, and out the window when there's credit to be given. I mean, so people do understand this. It's just we are so obsessed with the cults of personality that we see in a Jeff Bezos or an Elon Musk, and we think that's the role model. And then we wonder why the economy doesn't work and the society doesn't work and people are so unhappy.
Mm-hmm. It's very ego driven. And, you know, ego is often run by fear. And the other model is offering, coming from a love place. And you talk about that in your book too. And so another thing is the levels of mature leadership. So we're really talking about a mature leadership. And I think we're all kind of we're looking for that, even in our politicians, you know, we're looking for it, rare to find, but you have broken it up into intellectual, emotional, spiritual, and physical. And those are all the levels of being a human that we all were.
I don't call them levels. I call them domains. They're all the domains in which we have opportunities to mature. You know, whether it's the physical level, by which I don't mean being a superb athlete. I mean being comfortable in the body you have, being at home in your own skin, being accepting of other people's bodies in their own skins, you know, all of the just ability to use your body to take in information, which it does exquisitely well, and utilize that information again in service of what needs to happen. Meg Wheatley has a great phrase, what wants and needs to happen. And I think that's what a physically mature person does. It doesn't have anything to do with gray hair or wrinkles or anything. It is someone who listens to their gut and their heart as much as their head. You know, emotional maturity, boy, we don't see much of that on the public stage these days. But it's fundamentally the ability to listen and not need to talk. And then the gift, David White has, the poet, has a great line about poets of old would listen in times of crisis and then step forward and tell people what was going on because they had this great historical context for it. And then they would describe to them, this is the phrase I love, their beckoning collective future. This is where we're all invited to go. And that's a kind of emotional intelligence that I find fantastic. Intellectual intelligence is really that reality piece. Can you deal with the facts, or do you have to spin out and make up things because you can't be that grounded person who can absorb and interpret the facts? And spiritual maturity, again, is the ability to be at peace with what is without, how do I say this? Without giving up or giving in. You know, if you're spiritually mature, there's a way that what is, and that's okay. And you can make space for other people and their what is to be equally okay. And it doesn't mean that you don't aspire to something even better. You balance both of those things. And all of those have yin qualities and yang qualities. And all of those at peak maturity balance yin and yang. They're not more one than the other. They're a very healthy balance of the two of them.
Yeah, so, I think balanced. I mean, we're looking for that balance. A lot of people think, well, the feminists and, you know, we want the woman to take over. We want more women leaders, but we want the balance. You know, we want men and women and the yin and the yang working together because yeah. Both are needed. Both play an important role. And that's the only way that it can really work. Well, another aspect in the book you talk about is yin elderhood.
Yes, this is my favorite thing. I find that young people today are hungry for elders, for people who've been down the road and seen it and survived it and can say it's doable. And that's not the same as saying it's easy. And who make them feel perceived and valued. You know, in a lot of indigenous cultures, they have what they call spiritual adoption. And the whole village watches all the children. And various people in the village will spot a kid and say, this one has abilities that I can help develop. And somebody else will say, that one has abilities that I can help develop. And they work with those kids so that the kids are perceived and valued and given a path that makes sense to them and fits who they are. They're not, you know, molded into corporate cogs. They're not forced into regimens of education that aren't real education. They're regurgitation. You know, it's a different kind of world, but I think that notion of being at home in ourselves and an invitation to a different view of aging is so important right now, because as a culture, we're aging phobic. We hate it. You know, baby boomers all want to stay young forever. Not all. I'm a baby boomer, but that general emphasis on youthfulness and being, you know, energetic and cool and hip, and that's not what old people are for. They're for telling the stories that got you through and teaching it to the next generation. You know, we don't do that anymore.
Yeah, there's the stories. And what's important you're talking about is the intergenerational, the communication between, because we learn from the young people too. I find I do.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And there is an importance of valuing the elders' gift, and not, they have their gifts, they have their voice, they have their stories, but they also have their mistakes to share. Like, you know, it's important to let people know, I kind of blew it here, because if we don't, people will think, this person is on a pedestal and is perfect. And it helps to know, like, oh, they made mistakes too. It validates. Yeah. I made mistakes too. So I can breathe. I can relax in that we're all going to make mistakes as we learn and grow.
In fact, it's the only way you learn and grow. You don't learn that much from your successes because you don't study them. You study your failures. You study your mistakes. You think, oh, I don't want to do that again. How do I avoid that? You know, that's where you learn.
That's true. Well, in the book, you offer a vision of a different future than the one we're headed towards. And there's a lot there in every aspect of our culture. So I don't want to get into that. But how do you see us getting there?
Well, I wrote that part of the book is called Future Perfect, because grammatically speaking, future perfect tense is something that will happen at some point. I wrote it because it became clear to me in the course of 2020 that everybody was so obsessed with getting back to normal. And all I could think was, normal was not good for us. Why do we want to get back there? And the reason was nobody had an alternative. So what I did in writing Future Perfect was hope to spark conversations, hope to get other people to write their own versions of it. No, I don't want it to be like that. You know, I had one friend said, but I want to live in a city. I love cities. Cities are great. I said, great, you write one. Write one in which there are fabulous cities in the future. I happen to think that big is bad. You know, I'm not saying I'm right. I'm just saying for me, this is what would work. And the whole point of it is to really get people thinking about, are there viable alternatives? I'm fascinated by the fact that in the last year, I've seen more economists saying, maybe growth isn't the be all and end all of an economy. An unthinkable thought. For lo, these many 50 years since Ernest Kallenbach wrote Ecotopia, and my father and I had an argument about whether a steady state economy was a good idea or not. Nobody has talked about it. Up until now, the only people who write alternative futures are science fiction writers, which is, I mean, they do some fabulous stuff, but it's not a widely read and influential in people's thinking kind of set of modeling. So I'm hoping just to spark a lot more conversation about how would we like it to be? We are not constrained to how it currently is. We could do it differently.
Yeah, that part of the book is a good place for people to take it and have conversations with their friends. Because yes, we all agree, but boy, it would bring about interesting conversations, I think. And with all this, do you have hope?
Do I have hope?
For some of these changes to come forward, for Yin leadership to show up.
I do. I don't have, how do I put this? I don't have mass media hope. I have small pocket hope. There are amazing things happening out there in the world, even as we blithely ride this train to doom. And I believe that there will be pockets where people do things differently, or maybe even more accurately, where people relearn how to do them in the ways that kept us surviving for tens of thousands of years before the last 5,000 of so-called modern civilization. I really feel like, and you see this in the environmental literature and you see it in other places, for example, that indigenous people have a lot to teach us about how to take care of the planet and how to make decisions and how to take care of one another. And some of that will survive somehow. I do think we're headed for a very rough patch, however.
And we're in the rough patch. we're there already.
Yeah. Well,
if you could give one tip for people to, and especially women, my audience is probably women, to offer women leaders how they can step into a leadership maturity and make use of this yin leadership. Just, offer one.
Listen to your bodies. There is so much wisdom in your body. You know, people don't know this, but there are more brain cells lining the perineum, the cavity that holds the heart, than there are up here. There are more brain cells lining your gut than there are up here. You know, what we think of as the brain is one third of a tripartite pretty amazing structure, and we privilege this part and ignore the rest of it. Listen to your bodies. There's so much that you already know. And if you follow that wisdom, you will do right more often than not.
So true. Well, thank you so much, Lisa, for being here and sharing your story and your wisdom.
Thank you. This is lovely.
Yeah, I'd like to invite people to check out the Women of Wisdom website, womenofwisdom.org. It's not posted yet, but we will be posting. We'll be having intros to our Circle Leadership Program, intros in our meetup group, and the courses will start in October. So I encourage you to check that out. It's very much in alignment with Lisa's work. And thank you for what you are bringing to us through this. This little book has lots of words of wisdom.
Thank you. And if people are interested in finding the book, the shorthand version is yinjourney.com, and you can order it there. So,
right, yinjourney.com.
Yinjourney.com.
Yes. And I encourage you to get the book.
Thank you. All right.